Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 249.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this episode I present one of my favorite panels I've ever done. From Dragon Con 2016, just a few months ago now, this is the Hugo Award Winners Minus 50. This past year was the 50th anniversary of the first Hugo Awards ceremony, and there were some really amazing nominees and winners. And so I approached the Sci-Fi Lit Track and the wonderful Sue Phillips about doing a panel where we could talk about what the Hugo Awards were like the first year, that very first year, 50 years ago then. And so Sue found two great panelists to join me on the show. That was Bill Fawcett and Bill Rich, and they'll introduce themselves here in just a moment. They're really fascinating guys with lots of great knowledge, memories, and insight about these works. And so together, I think we had a very fun panel on the Lit Track at Dragon Con. We'll get onto that in just a second, but first let me remind you, lots of changes going on here on the network, and very soon we will have lots more shows mixed into the feed, so don't be surprised and startled. You get a lot of variety coming up here just for subscribing to the One White Rocket Entertainment Network. Please also leave us a review on iTunes, or at least a rating, a star rating. We would appreciate that. The show needs it. We need visibility to compete with all the other podcasts out there. So if you enjoy what we're doing here, go to iTunes and leave a review. And also, of course, please go by whiterocketbooks.com. We have lots of science fiction, fantasy, nonfiction, commentary-type books there from several different artists, from several different authors, I should say. Well, lots of great artists, too. So you can help support the show that way, too. We'll take all the support we can get as we continue to try to bring you the best in absolutely free, great conversations and entertainment. Now, on with Dragon Con 2016, the Hugo Award winners minus 50. It's time. We're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to Sunday at Sci-Fi Literature. This is the Hugo and Nebula winners minus 50. So the plan at first is to look at the 1966 Hugo and Nebula Awards, and then with whatever time we have after that, which may be a little or maybe a lot, we can talk about some other Hugo and Nebula Awards for sure. I am Van Allen Plexico, and I am the author of 14 science fiction novels and quite a few nonfiction books, and won the 2015 Pulp Factory Award for Novel of the Year for Legion 3, Kings of Oblivion. And I'm a professor of history and political science at Southwestern Illinois. And I also host the White Rocket Podcast, a bi-weekly show where we talk about things like this sort of thing. So I'm recording this for that show. Let me throw over here to Bill.
I'm Bill Fawcett. I've been a book packager since the early 80s. I've written a number of fiction works, a couple of dozen, and a dozen and a half nonfiction. I've been an agent in this industry, and I'm pretty sure I'm on this because I'm old enough to remember some of this.
I thought that was my job.
And Bill, and
Bill, I'm Bill Rich, which we're probably about the same age, and I read the Hugo nominees, all of them in the Hugo nominee book back in 1967 when it came out, and I was in high school, so I have that authority on this. Plus, I've been a science fiction fan for a long time, been involved with Worldcon and Worldcon politics. I am the president of the Atlanta Radio Theater Company for the past 15 or 20 years, and I've been doing a lot of radio theater, in which we're doing 5 shows this weekend at Dragon Con, including one tonight. And I've written a couple short stories that have gotten published. That's about it for my published work.
They won't see this on the podcast, but yes, I am wearing a suit. I do not wear suits to panels. I'm awarding the Dragon Awards. I'm the MC next
hour.
Yay!
Speaking of awards, so
fantastic.
Speaking of Dragon Awards, how come there's no audio drama category? I have to ask,
because it's duplicated by the book category.
No, audio drama. Not
we're not doing performance. We're doing the literature and the design and the game. And we only we already have 15.
Okay.
Which is probably the most honest answer.
Yeah, okay. But audio drama.
I will explain to you.
Yeah.
We worked really hard, with the exception of one we couldn't avoid, outstanding movie,
yep,
to not duplicate any of the Hugo or Nebula categories.
Ah, well, they don't have an audio drama either.
They were going to.
Oh, okay. And I think this might be a better award than the Hugos and Nebulas coming up. That's what I'm hoping. So, anyway, that's my political point. Sorry.
Well, the reason that there's a couple of reasons. Well, actually, there's several reasons. Okay, let me just keep backing up.
The many reasons.
Yes, suddenly it's the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes.
Among the many reasons that I wanted to start with 1966, the Nebulas started in 1966, okay? So you couldn't really do Hugos and Nebulas in 1965. You kind of have to start with 66. Two, it's the 50th anniversary, which kind of made sense. And also, it was the first time and only time the Hugos did a one-off all-time series award, which I think will be fun to talk about for a minute. We can get some meat out of that. And then also, if you just look at the works that were nominated and won and lost that year, it's kind of mind-blowing that they all were out in the same year. So there were several reasons I thought this would be kind of a fun year to start off, digging into and really look at. So you want to kind of do the Hugos first and the Nebulas, or how you guys want to do it? Okay.
Hugos first.
So first up, I'll tell you the nominees that year. And this is one of my favorite Hugo novel years because of how it turned out. The nominees were Skylark Duquesne.
Duquesne.
Okay.
We'll fix that for you.
I got 2 hours of sleep last night. By E.E. Doc Smith. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein.
Yep.
The Squares of the City by John Brunner. And when the John Brunner book is the one that's kind of the least known, that's saying something, I think.
Yep.
And then And Call Me Conrad, which became the novel This Immortal by Roger Zelazny. And then a little book called Dune by Frank Herbert. Those were the nominees, okay? And the winner was...
Why isn't Kevin here? It was Dune.
And No.
Not for the Hugo.
It was a tie.
Yeah, they tied.
It was a tie between
Zelazny and Herbert.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's why I like to point out that one of Roger's, y'all know I'm a big Roger Zelazny fan, huge Roger Zelazny fan. One of Roger Zelazny's lesser known works tied freaking Dune for best novel. So I love this year. That's just amazing.
They got him with Lord of Light 2 years later by himself.
Right. So that's the best novel category. What do you guys think about that? Let's talk about that just for a couple of minutes. Wait a minute,
because Moon is a Harsh Mistress did win a Hugo. Was this
the next year? They duplicated
Elsmere the 1 year, won the next year
to be in the year following running because of the
way it was serialized.
So
serialized is qualified in both periods.
Interesting.
So when you think about it that way, three of those I just mentioned all got Hugos.
Yeah.
the two that tied, and then won the next year.
Now, ties were a lot easier in those days.
Yeah.
You voted at WorldCon, and WorldCon attendance in 1966 was measured in the hundreds, and not the many hundreds. And it was held in one hotel, and they didn't fill it back in the days when we were in high school and all.
It's getting back there, though, unfortunately.
And it wasn't actually very publicized. It was really very much a writer's conference in those days. So this is very much, at that point, a peer in the hardcore award. And this shows the results.
Yeah, because Zelazny was respected as a writer's writer in a way that maybe Dune is like a thing that kind of hit maybe as a bigger popular work, right? Because I know that Dune, even then, was selling more copies than
Dune took off.
But for sure.
Yeah. Roger was probably the leading technical writer as far as his writing skill introducing new writing techniques to the industry.
Let's make it clear, too. This is the Hugos, and for those that don't know, they are chosen by the membership of the World Science Fiction Convention. So theoretically, I guess, at least theoretically, you have a lot more people voting for them than for the Nebulas, although, like you say, at that stage, it might have been about the same.
It was pretty much the same people, too.
And the same people.
Yeah, just
point.
Some of the Hugo fans weren't eligible for the Nebulas, but a tiny percentage comparatively.
I was not old enough to have been admitted then, although this is about the time they were calling Isaac Asimov the snot-nosed kid, as I remember. At least timeline-wise, when he started winning awards.
Yes.
But the membership was probably over half of names you would recognize today as the founders of the field. And the other half was primarily the committee.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yep. Yeah, I wasn't going to Hugo Awards then. I was too young. I was still in high school.
I had two more years to exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my mother wouldn't let me.
Oh, yes, exactly.
I had it in Chicago, and she wouldn't let me.
Oh, really?
Wow.
I was 15.
Oh, but it was safe.
It was science fiction. It was strange.
Oh,
it was with weird people. It was a little genre in a corner that the library sort of hid with little spaceships on the end.
Yes, I remember that.
It was so different.
Yeah, that's another thing is you guys who, well, there are some people in this audience who are young enough to know that science fiction has always been a big thing. But back when we were, when this, 1966, it was just starting to get some acceptance. Mm-hmm. And Dune was one of the things that helped it get that acceptance. Heinlein, of course, but Dune, because it was such a brilliant novel.
Introduced in the 50s. The 60s was the age of the paperback book, and that is what helped give us the launch. More than anything else, science fiction, when the demand for a lot of books came out, had enough people who were genre writers that they could start filling shelves with paperback books. And the paperback explosion of the early 60s is part of what helped launch science fiction. Some of you are old enough to be here, but to talk back on us, you have no idea what a ghetto it was in the 60s and 70s. When I began teaching in 69, and I could not convince the library to get more than about a dozen classic science fiction books. And as somebody after Jules Verne, the librarian, would say, and the Chicago school system wasn't big on risk anyhow. And we really, really did not get recognition. Now, we're living in a different era today. I mean, if you read the bestseller list, you watch television, you see what the top movies for the last 10 years are.
All science fiction fantasy horror.
I have in my lifetime gone from where I had to explain what science fiction was to everyone, including my parents, to we won.
Yep.
And we are inherent in the culture. I mean, I work with Navy SEALs who talk about how tough they are using the phrase hit points.
Well, they play D&D as kids.
Right.
Some of them play D&D on mission.
Yes.
Now.
Currently, right. Yeah.
With weapons. Anyway.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Yeah. Let me ask you guys this then. Which of those, because I want to kind of do this as we go along, if you're up for it, and you may not have all read all of them, but which of those, certainly we can make a shot for this one, which of those should have won?
Well,
Dune or This Immortal or The Harsh Mistress, or
you know, pretty much all. I mean, seriously, if you think about it, in fact, I was looking at the list of the Nebula nominees, which is even longer.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And there's some great books in there. There's two Philip K. Dick books, you know, which were not destined to be able to win, but brilliant novels, because Dick was insane and brilliant at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple that you've never heard of, but Clifford Simek's All Flesh is Grass, a fantastic book I've read. Nova Express by William Burroughs. What the hell?
Yeah, William Burroughs?
And, I mean, that was on the syphilis list, but it was a science fiction book, and it was effectively New Wave science fiction back then. It was really big. Dr. Blood Money, or How We Got Along After the Bomb, Philip K. Dick. And then Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, one of Dick's best books.
When you look at the winners here of this, you notice there's sort of, there were books that were from different generations of science fiction. Skylark of Duquesne is the last, almost, of the great Dockey E. Smith books, which had been around for 20 years with some of the most sweeping scenes.
30 years,
since the 30s. And they are, if you have not read them, a fascinating read. Just read one to have read one, because he was perhaps the first person to think on a scale of, and then the million ships spread their shields and we swept up the stars.
Yes.
kind of scene. And the technology is wonderful. He talks about the 70-foot-across electronic bus bars to carry the anti-gravity waves.
The giant 3D tanks, which were basically holograms, except they didn't have that word then.
Yeah, he predicted a lot of things that became standard later on. No warp drive, no teleporter, no Star Trek stuff. But the real basis of our science fiction was very much his generation. And this book is the last of that generation. And then you get into the Rogers Lozny book, and you get into Squares of the City, and those are the social science fiction that was extremely popular in the 60s. Stand on Zanzibar, all of these.
Well, Stand on, which did win a Hugo.
A couple of years
I don't think it won a Nebula, but it didn't.
Did win a Hugo.
Hugo in the 68
and,
or so.
Which is, if you haven't read, so incredibly pertinent to today. It is so, you read it and go, oh, right. It and Bug Jack Baron have not aged it a day.
Okay, so Stand on Zanzibar, brilliant, brilliant book. Sort of inspired by John Dos Passos series.
The title sounds really weird, right? At the time when Norman Spinrad was writing it, you could, if everybody stood shoulder to shoulder, everyone in the human race would just fit on the island of Zanzibar. Hence the title. And as the book goes on and overpopulation and crowding and ecological disaster become more important, they start edging the human race into the water and it begins drowning.
Yes.
And that's the concept of, is a symbolism behind the name. The book itself is the dystopia that we're starting to live today, predicted 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Overpopulation, pollution, mutations, even has genetic
engineering
screwing up.
So I read that in one sitting. I sat down to read it one Saturday afternoon, and I could not put it down.
In any case, that is social commentary, socially driven.
New wave.
New wave to a large degree. And then we have the classic era, the Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and Dune. Which are the classic high science fiction. Dune being...
Dune was like interesting because it was both, because you had...
Social commentary.
I mean, you had a lot of social commentary. That's what...
Environmental
politics and
very much a product of the period.
But then it's a space opera.
Anthropology.
But it also has the massive space opera that you won't find in Squares of the City.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it was a transitional, I would call it.
And all that philosophy woven through it, too. I mean, I always say Star Wars is Dune if you strip out all the philosophy and environmentalism and all the other deep-thinking stuff and just leave kind of the plot. You know?
By the way, if you really love Dune, you've got to get Beer. Harvard Lampoon, who also did Board of the Rings, did a Dune
Oh, right.
D-O-O-N.
D-O-O-N.
No, it's D-O-O-N.
They yeah, do, D-O-O-N.
But it has beer as a major, it's spice. The main, beer is the spice.
Instead of spice, it was beers, and they were truckers. And stuff.
Yes.
And it works.
It's pretty cute.
It's brilliant.
It's not quite Board of the Rings, but it's right up
because
there.
Because Board of the Rings was brilliant.
It was the most brilliant comedy
if
I ever.
If you read who did Board of the Rings, it reads like the who's who of television 10 years later.
Yes,
Lord.
The Harvard Lampoon were all these. Dick Cavett was one of the team. I mean, it was all these brilliant people. Buckley.
Well, yeah. I thought he was Yale.
What?
I think Cavett was Yale.
No, Cavett was Yale. It was not Cavett.
It was
Beard.
Beard.
Yeah,
Henry
Beard.
That
I'm thinking
Doug Kenny.
The Kenny, that's right.
Later on, they'd all be ready for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, amazing
things like
people
that.
Wrote that.
It's fantastic.
But if you haven't read Board of the Rings, do it. And if you haven't read Doom,
with two
D-O-O-N,
yeah.
So they get sued. It was done without any legal permission,
yeah.
By the way.
None of them.
It's got a giant pretzel on the cover with a guy riding it.
Yeah, because the sandworms look like pretzels. It's worth doing. Anyhow, so the point is that this was very much a transition period with different almost subgenres of science fiction in it, any one of which was the best novel in its subgenre.
Yes.
Which is why it's on this list. Yeah.
And what's also weird is that the camaraderie between the prose was, it was not as factional as it is today, shall we say. There's a lot more factionalism in hue politics and science fiction
not
fandom.
Not among the pros. No, I
even
mean,
now,
that's my
even
world.
Now,
and no, I mean
there's some.
There are a few. There are maybe a couple dozen who have concerns with this.
Yeah.
But among the people that are often the nominees.
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of camaraderie. We have so much more in common. It's hard. Remember. It takes you a while in the industry to realize that science fiction is not a zero-sum game.
Yep.
If science fiction had been a product where so many can be sold and you've got to get your portion of the market, toothpaste, soap, whatever, then Harry Potter would have doomed all of the rest of our industry. Right
instead
there.
Instead it
literally gave us a geometric leap in young... That's why young adults are wonderful now. Because well, nothing's
there's
perfect.
Always the backlash side
she's
of everything.
A friend too. But the point is that just because you're friendly, just because you're cooperative,
yes.
Just because you'll even talk scripts with each other, doesn't mean you don't compete on.
No, you do. You are competitive, but I mean, Heinlein and Herbert knew each other, and Heinlein helped out Philip K. Dick several times because, you know, Dick had problems, lots of problems.
Well, yeah, this is about the time that Anne McCaffrey had gotten divorced from Johnson and was maintaining an apartment in New York with a constant bowl of spaghetti. And all the starving and hungry writers of New York, most of whom are the Hugo winners for the next 20 years,
yes.
Used to stop by Annie's and do that. This is also the time, or right before the time, when Annie McCaffrey and Gordon Dixon were quite a number for about a decade.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I know about Judy Merle and, you know, most of Prodom.
But yes, they knew each other very well.
Okay. We're talking euphemistically, you're right.
I'm sorry. Annie made no secret of this. When Gordy died, Annie and I were commiserating, and I said, "Do you ever regret that his mother kept you from getting married?" And Annie, this is being a podcast, I'll keep it clean. And Annie basically looked at me and said, "No, if we had gotten together, we wouldn't have gotten out of bed to get a lot of good books written."
So I went to my first Worldcon in 1976, and this was, you know, a little later than this. And all of these greats were, you know, the royalty. And they treated, you know, 22-year-old fanboy like, "Oh, it's great. Hi, come into our parties," and things like that. I sat and drank with Gordy and Paul Anderson and, you know, went to the suite where Heinlein had... you know, had his, you know, where he sits around in his bathrobe and holds court.
He held court.
Yeah, held court. Which,
like Hugh Hefner.
Robert Heinlein of the 60s was Bob Ashburn of the 80s.
Yeah. Or like he said, Hugh Hefner.
Held court
forever.
In the borrower's room with free booze.
Yes. And, you know, fanboy allowed in. It was great. It was just amazing. And it was a different time.
we enjoy our Mardi Gras for nerds here on our 30th anniversary Dragon Con.
Yes, we do.
And what you don't realize is this is a continuation of the spirit that's gone on since basically there were the early science fiction conventions. The egalitarian attitude, the shared interest has always led to a really strong spirit of just everybody's another fan.
But we haven't banned one entire group of fans like they did in 1939. When they kept the Futurians out.
Well,
that was a great move.
Let's not go. Yeah. Anyhow, we won't go into that one. I was being wonderfully philosophical.
You didn't, yes.
Anyhow, but really, the inspiration for Dragon Con was that there was politics getting in, and we just wanted to have a fan thing. Mm-hmm. And my God, did that work?
Oh yeah,
scary.
Yeah, it certainly has.
So, what about for the non-novels, because there were some great novelettes.
Before I mention the best short fiction, and that's pretty amazing, too.
You know, we managed to not answer your question, both of us, very well.
You did.
What was your question?
I will cast a vote before you do that. I think that probably for the period and for the commentary, Muna Jahar's Mistress was probably that. And the reason I say that is because that was an era when we were recording readers, and that is a book that brought readers into the industry as much as Dune did.
Well, I'm extremely biased because it is my favorite novel, period, you know, including all the famous novels. It is my absolute favorite novel, and I've read it at least 6 times, so I am extremely biased. I would have voted for that. Oh, yeah.
And see, for me, it's really tough because there's no way I would vote against Roger Zelazny. But, I mean, Dune. I mean, you know, so I...
Yeah, but Dune.
So I'm good with the tie. I'm good with the tie. I'll split my vote in half. Now, again, we're also answering the question, can we do an entire hour on the 66 Hugos and Edulis?
Looks like we can do it on one topic.
I think we're going to do a whole tower and not cover all the 66 Hugos and Edulis. So.
Well, we have meandered.
Well, we have, and that's inevitable. Now,
I hope we're interesting.
This is what I think is amazing. Before I mention the short fiction, best dramatic presentation in 1966, insufficient nominations, not on ballot.
Yes.
So there weren't enough movies and TV shows of science fiction fantasy in 1965, 66 to even have nominees.
Which was about to change.
How has that changed, right?
No, that was about to change that year, 66.
Well, 66, exactly, of course.
Because this was like things were out in 65.
Right, because after
there
this,
wasn't much. There was something called Lost in Space.
Yeah!
But not what the, you know, people over 12 wanted to vote for.
Right.
It wasn't supposed to be.
No, it wasn't. No,
Lost in Space was supposed to be an adult primetime show.
I know. I've seen the pilot, which would have been good.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't do that.
It's closer to the movie, actually. What?
Episode. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
even space.
Yeah, it was just not... but anyway, in 66, all of a sudden, things changed completely in the dramatic.
Yeah, for the next couple of years, like 3 Star Trek episodes are among the nominees, you know. So
and then 68, which
2001.
2001, yes.
Sure.
Which
okay, so the short fiction. This is interesting too. I feel like Roger Zelazny probably cruised the entire year thinking that Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth was going to win because it came out in March, and along in December, Harlan Ellison puts out Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man, and Roger's like, screw it.
Yes.
And the other nominees were Mark and Reprisal by Paul Anderson, Day of the Great Shout by Philip Jose Farmer, and Stardock by Fritz Lieber. So again, that's a pretty stellar array of authors and stories. And I'm okay. Again, I mean, you know, Roger tied Dune, so that's nice. But I'm okay with, I think, Harlan pulling that one out.
Harlan was a snot-nosed kid.
He was
what they called the Asimov, but yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, well, we all, you know, he's, 5 years older than me and semi-retired, and we still want to hunt him down? You can never not admire Harlan's use of words. And I'm going to say this, and you're all going to look at me funny, and his humility about his writing.
Yes.
Okay.
Not as a person, but about his writing. I was at a Chicago Comic Con about 15 years ago, and he was sitting next to Jody Lynn Nye, who's my wife and I, there's a couple authors, and he said, you know, I'm waiting for the gotcha. And I went, Harlan, what? Make somebody mad? You know, I'm just blocking punches for him. And he goes, no, I'm getting, as more I do this, the more I'm figuring out how much I don't know about writing and how much better I could be if I kept working at certain things and how I'm trying to do this. And I've been spending my entire career waiting for someone up to walk out to me and go, you're faking it. You don't know as much, and you're not as good as people say.
Wow. Imposter syndrome.
He has terrible imposter syndrome, and he always, and he's very humble about his writing and extremely generous with other writers.
Yes, and that's the thing is, there's the public Harlan, and especially when he's on and challenged, and he can be, you know, a little bit of an asshole, and then there's the private Harlan, who can be the most wonderful person in the entire world.
Yes.
I've worked with him several times.
I value his friendship. He's wonderful.
He's a great guy. Great guy.
But I had him on my show last year, and he was a very, very sweet guy.
He always is, unless he's either angry or decides he wants to bait you. And the problem with being Harlan baiting you with words is like a Navy SEAL deciding he wants to shoot around you. He's one of the best.
And it's gonna he'll probably intentionally miss you, but
it's going to be real effective.
You know.
And they are going to get angry.
Yeah, he's very good at that.
And no, this was one of many wonderful things he did, but one of the best even to this day. It's a very strong story if you haven't read it. And incredibly relevant again 50 years later.
Well, it's almost like his defining thing. If you think Harlan Ellison, you think TikTok man. You know, it's really...
I have no mouth and I must scream.
Yes.
Now, what Harlan was a title giver of absolute mastercraft.
Absolutely.
He could name a book so wonderfully, you didn't care what was in it. You had to read it to find out why he chose
that title.
A Boy and His Dog.
Yep.
What's it, the Demon with a Glass Hand?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was
so many.
Outer Limits episode, one of his Outer Limits episodes.
That's amazing.
And he is a great writer. He hasn't written a lot much recently, but you know he's a fantastic.
Been writing scripts that pay so much better.
Yeah, exactly. That's the other thing. Is a lot of people we lost, and back in this period, there were a lot of science fiction writers who were writing for Hollywood. They were writing it for TV shows, so like Ray Bradbury, Charles Beaumont, Richard Matheson went to television and still wrote short stories and things like that.
Yeah, you do what you love and then you do what they pay you for. I can name at least three masters of our field who are writing pornography in this period in order to make a living.
And some later.
We won't mention Mike at all, right?
No, except one of their sons came out and exposed his father.
Yeah.
Yes. But, that was a very interesting story.
But Andy used to tell us that all the time. You know, he would sit around and say, oh yeah, I've written this. I won't tell you all the names, but you should read the ones by him.
All right, both Andy Offutt and Mike Resnick have come out that they had to write pornography to pay for their early marriage.
Right.
You know, the most interesting thing to me about that whole story, though, about, I guess it was Andy Offutt, was that he was saying how, in terms of writing, he said that his father would sit there, be watching a TV show, be watching a movie, whatever, with legal pads, and he would write down descriptions, pages and pages of descriptions of everything he was seeing on the TV show, like the geographical, the settings, whatever. And then he'd just file all those away, and when he'd be writing a book, he would just go dig out a legal pad and use that pre-written description to type out he didn't have to sit there and make up a whole new, oh, dang, man, this guy just is what, plug and play before there was plug and play. Amazing. It's amazing. Well, so who do you like as the winner there? Is it Repent Harlequin, or is there something that should have...
They got it right.
They got it right. I feel like the Doors of His Face, Lamps of His Mouth won. Maybe the Nebula? We'll see.
Ellison won that too, but that's short story. The Nebula had... novellas.
Because I felt like it won something.
Oh, yeah, because I'm thinking that it won the novelette category. Yes, that's the novelette category that it won in the Nebula.
And they weren't always the same year, too. Like, I've seen some things that are in the 66 Hugos that would be in the 67 Nebulas or something like that.
They had different rules.
Yeah,
right.
The length varied. When it came out, one was show to show, like we do the Dragon Awards. Mm-hmm. Books coming out from now on or from next year. But the Hugos are annual year, and it's January to December. So you could get a book that was eligible 1 year for one thing and the next year for another. And it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys are interested in talking about Best Professional Magazine. The winner was IF, edited by Frederick Pohl.
Which was a very good magazine.
Sure.
So IF and Galaxy were like sister magazines, and for years they were edited by Gold, H.L. Gold, who was trying to be the John W. Campbell of the 1950s, you know, to replace John Campbell, who'd been the Campbell of the 40s. And then, I think, did Gold die or did he retire or something?
He died.
He died while he was in office, basically. And Fred Pohl took over. And,
both of them.
And right, well, because it was the same, like as they were published by the same company. And Fred Pohl had a completely different vision than Gold, but he wasn't as, his personality wasn't as strong with the magazine. But he was a good editor. I mean, he was a great editor and a great writer. And so he really shaped IF. IF was a great magazine in the 60s. I have a complete collection of the IFs of that period.
IF was great. Noted for introducing stories you wouldn't find in the other magazines that were really good.
I think he introduced Keith Laumer to the world. Keith Laumer's a fantastic writer, and I think was Dune was published in Galaxy.
Dune,
I think
Dune was serialized. You have to realize most of the books, because it was so hard to make a living writing the books, mm-hmm. would first be serialized in a magazine. And then published by one of the few regular companies. There was no Ace yet. It was, or there was now.
No,
it was getting
Ace.
Going because it was Jim.
Yeah, no, Ace was. Ace did exist in the
60s. Ace did
exist
because he had the Ace doubles and everything.
Right. Yeah. So in the 60s, you had paperback originals.
Yeah.
So there weren't very many hardbacks. Dune was it serial? It was serialized. But
Galaxy,
it came out by Chilton.
Chilton, yeah.
Now, what is Chilton known for? Publishing novels?
Manuals.
Cars.
That's
car
what he could get.
Manuals.
That's all he could get to do it.
What the hell? One of the greatest novels ever written.
Mm-hmm.
He had a hard time getting published.
That's not unusual. When you break new ground, Hunt for Red October could never get published.
Exactly.
Little side story. It was published eventually because he had a friend in the government by the Naval Institute Press.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we all benefited from that because they got a deal that the Naval Institute Press got 50% of all future income for putting out the 10,000 book edition of Hunt for Red October, who then sold it to Penguin Putnam. At that point, Penguin Putnam made millions on it. Half of it went to Naval Institute Press. And the other job Naval Institute Press is they print the Congressional Record. And for a year, they did not have to request a budget from Congress for printing the National Record because Hunt for Red October paid for it. So they saved us all a few bucks.
This is the Congressional Record brought to you by Hunt for Red October. They should let Tom Clancy give a speech to start every day in Congress that year.
He would have, too.
He would have, too, yeah.
And they would not have liked
it. No, that's true, yeah.
They would not have
Some of the others that were in the running that year, Pohl himself again for Galaxy, so he's he won over himself, plus also John W. Campbell Analog, Joseph Furman Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Joseph or Ed?
Ed Furman.
Joseph W. Furman.
Because Joseph was the publisher, I think, and
Ed Furman was
the editor.
Okay, I'm just going by what it says there.
Yeah.
And then Amazing Science...
Put his name on it.
Okay. Amazing Science Fiction Stories by Goldsmith. Best Professional Artist, the only one I really want to mention there, because Kelly Freeze, I don't know these other three. Oh, Greg Morrow.
Greg Morrow, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean... But Frank Frazetta won, and I just love the idea that in the same year that you had these, like, Dune and Repent Harlequin and all that, you have Frank Frazetta and his fantastic... fantasy art, which has sold so many books because people just, they want the book to be like that cover, you know.
Mm-hmm. Conan.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And I think, wasn't the cover to Dune by, was either by Gauguin, was it Gauguin?
I've seen so many covers of Dune.
Not about the original.
Right.
The Chilton one.
Right.
And John Schoenherr was an artist for... Astounding Analog for years and years.
He did covers.
And he did covers too. And he did
for
interiors.
Analog. He did a lot of them.
So all of those people I've heard of.
Okay.
Every single one of those people.
All right.
I can show you illustrations. I almost recognize their art.
I'm very happy about Frazetta for one.
Yes.
Are you interested in fanzine? The Edgar Rice Burroughs, I guess, magazine one. Camille Cassidesus Jr.
You have to understand, in the 60s, they re-released everything of Burroughs. I read it all in high school. Yep. All of the John Carters, all of the everything.
Mm-hmm.
All the Pellucidar Inner Earths. All 30-something Tarzan books. It generated its own sub-fandom rather extensively for a while.
And a lot of it was because of the covers. In the early 60s, it was... what was his name? It was before Frank Frazetta. It was Roy Crinkle Jr.
Okay.
Who influenced Frank Frazetta, and then in the 60s you had all these books coming out with beautiful Roy Crinkle Jr. covers, and then Frank Frazetta started doing these same kind of covers for Tarzan and
Conan.
Suitably clad women.
Yes, and the beautiful cover for Princess of Mars from the book club. Which is what they should have used for that stupid movie. They should have used that. It could have sold it. And then later, Boris started doing the same thing.
That's right. But yeah, Boris is kind of that tradition. Was this when the Wold Newton stuff first came out, where they tried to tie the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff and the Philip Jose Farmer was kind of...
I think that was later. I think he was doing that in the 70s.
That was in the 70s.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, he was tying it all together.
The thing I've been really wanting to talk about before we get out of the Hugos for this year is best all-time series. I love that they just randomly picked a year and said, let's just give an award for the best all-time book series. Now, you couldn't even begin to do that almost now because everything's a series.
Yeah, there were fewer series.
We actually, if you read our instructions... Uh-huh. You can vote for a science fiction series for a Dragon Award.
Oh, okay.
If a book came out during our period in that series.
Okay.
We give the award to the series, not the book necessarily.
Okay.
Because, let's look at the recent Hugos. Red Shirts is an interesting book. Old Man's War was the Hugo winner.
Was a better book.
Brilliant book.
Yeah.
Brilliant book. Stop Me Dead.
Yep.
Cost me a night's sleep. Called him up and swore at him. I mean, how dare you write this good? I'm not going to be able to produce a word for a month. You know,
it was a great book.
It was brilliant by John, and it was brilliant all the way through, even the writing, except for the crack about the Cubs not winning for 200 years. And I'm from Chicago. And it's way too close to home. Maybe this year. We're counting. Yeah, right. It's they're 14 games up. They're going to find a way to blow it. Anyhow. Point is that we're allowing it now because it's the world.
Yes.
There's no use giving something for volume 7 when you know it's really for 1 through 7.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So we're acknowledging this now.
Yes, and a lot of stuff is like, there are books that can sustain greatness all the way through their multiple series. And then a lot of series where it's like the first couple, three, you know, and then there's some fall off. We were talking about that on the Farmer panel. You know, he sort of lost interest, but they still published
River World, and
some of the other ones too. And River World,
No, you can get an Amber series where the last one's as strong as the first one regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Hugo that he won for Lord of Light caused Amber to happen, you know, but it wasn't causing him to write it. Do you know the story about
Amber? No,
probably, but tell me next year.
Well, Roger was a teacher, and he had the summer. Brother is a brilliant teacher and also a martial arts instructor. I'd love to have had Roger for a teacher. My God. Anyhow, Hungarians are good at that. I married one. Anyhow, he got an inspiration in July, and he sat down and did nearly 300,000 words just poured out of him. Now, this is typewriter, remember, people.
Yeah.
This is pages of documents. It's, you know, a 10-inch pile of pages. And then the summer ended, and he hadn't quite finished all of what he was going to do in it. It had been very long. It was about 300,000 words. He shoved it in a drawer under the theory that although he had worked meticulously on the other books, this had just poured out of him, and it probably really wasn't any good, just catharsis.
Mm-hmm.
About the next Worldcon, Lord of Light wins.
Mm-hmm.
And Lester and Judy are on the phone going, you just won the Hugo. Where's another book?
Yes.
What have you got?
Because that's what editors do.
And,
if they're any good.
And Roger went, okay, I got something here, but you can't judge it too harshly, and I'll send you this book in. It's really overlong. We'll have to break it up. But I just poured it out because it interested me. And so if you don't like this book called Castle Amber, let me know. And of course, the first 90,000 words became Nine Princes in Amber, and that was it. But he literally wrote Nine Princes in Amber in the equivalent of 3 weeks.
Yep.
I've heard so many different versions of that.
He told me that himself when we were doing the guide to Castle Amber.
And there's a point in the Guns of Avalon where you can see the moment where he put it in the drawer for a while and then came back months later and had changed his mind about what was going to happen. And
over a year later,
and the character that totally changes in that is Ganelon, because before that, Ganelon was a buddy that was traveling with him, and after that, of course, he becomes a completely different character. And you can see the moment where he has to start changing him to set that up. It's really interesting. When you know that background and you read it, it's very obvious. But if you didn't know it, you wouldn't catch it.
Pre-Judy Lynn, post-Judy Lynn.
Ah,
there you go.
Yep.
So, all right, so series then. Mm-hmm. Here were the series nominees. I'll give you all the series nominees, and we'll see what we think about it. I'm going to go in a particular order. Let's see. The Future History series by Robert Heinlein. Okay. The Lensman series by E.E. Doc Smith.
Yeah.
The Barsoom series by Edgar Rice Burroughs. The Foundation series by Isaac Asimov, and The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, if this award were given
today,
you know what would win.
Yes.
Great movies.
That didn't win.
No.
Who won?
I know that.
Who won?
I'm even looking, because I remember. It was Asimov's Foundation trilogy. And, of course, the reason is, first of all, the Future History series is, shall we say, a loosely knit series.
Yeah,
it's all in the same universe, but there's nothing that connects them besides being in the quote same universe. Whereas the Foundation trilogy, even though it was written as a bunch of short stories or novellas, really, is coherent.
It is.
There's a beginning and end. It's like a big novel, but they didn't have novels the size of that. Lord of the Rings was written as a novel.
Big novel.
But it was fantasy. And even though the award is for both, you know, there was a huge science fiction bias back then.
Yeah.
Fantasy was Burroughs.
Yeah.
Fantasy was junk writing. Fantasy was a number of writers you don't remember in those days.
And I would bet.
And the reason was it didn't pay as well, and they popped them out like popcorn when they could. And they weren't always as good. And it wasn't until almost the 70s that fantasy got elevated to the
because of Lord of the Rings. I mean, remember that a lot of the people in this year, because it was 65, 66 when they were voting on, had not read Lord of the Rings, probably a lot of the things, because it was a fantasy book. And who the hell wants to read a fantasy book? And when Ace Books published,
I was going to say,
Ace Books,
which was controversial,
and then Ballantine published the real series, I think in 66, maybe 67.
Right.
But it became like the book of the generation, because it definitely the hippie generation embraced Lord of the Rings.
I was just undergrad in 68, and I had my hippie girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
We all look for hippie girlfriends. They had reputation.
Yes, there was a reason.
They're never true. It was always frustrating.
Yeah.
But, you know, the philosophers are not loose. It's a myth. Anyhow, she said, hey, why don't you read this? The Weekend of Finals, the spring semester.
Uh-huh.
I went from an A to a B in anthropology, because even I was writing Tolkien into my word questions on it, because that's all I could. I'd read all three books for those
Holy
three days
cow.
And had never studied for the final.
Wow.
When I was in high school and I got a copy of Lord of the Rings, I read it a week. Binge read.
Well, that was it. I virtually did not sleep for 3 days.
So I have a different story than most Americans, because when I was a kid, the children's librarian at the Miami Public Library loved the fact that I liked science fiction and fantasy. And she said, have you read this book? And it was The Hobbit.
Yeah.
And so I got started with The Hobbit, and then discovered Lord of the Rings a little bit later.
Hobbit is nowhere near as good a book as
it's a kid's book.
Opinion.
So it's a book that a kid would read.
Yeah, but
Lord of the Rings
so
is not.
Slowly.
that you have to be promised it's going to go better.
They're different things, almost set in the same universe, we say that. I wanted to say that there was a discussion at the time over whether Lord of the Rings should even be counted as a series because it was supposed to be one book. And they decided, it says the Rules Committee almost put it in contention for best novel instead. Yep. And how interesting would it have been if you'd thrown in Lord of the Rings alongside Dune and This Immortal and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress? Oh my gosh, did just. If This Immortal had beat Dune and tied Dune and beat Lord of the Rings, I'd be like, yeah, take that, you know? We got to get a couple of nebulas in here, and I want to have a couple of minutes for questions. So the nebula list is just insane, yes. But the winner was Dune. Novella was a tie between Brian Aldiss for The Saliva Tree and Roger Zelazny's He Who Shapes, which is the novella he later turned into Dream Master.
Yep.
And there's just 8 million nominees for the. And then the winner for novelette was Roger Zelazny. There's The Doors of the Face, Lamps of His Mouth, as we mentioned a while ago. And then best short story was Repent Harlequin, to the TikTok Man by Harlan Ellison. And let's see if there was any.
They didn't have a.
There weren't that many awards back then.
Right,
They did not have a movie award then. Came very late, much later.
No, the banquets were much nicer with just 3 awards.
Yeah.
It didn't take long at all. I wanted to get through those. Okay, so now we've already kind of covered that. I want to see if you guys have any questions in our last 10 minutes or so we can get to that.
I'll ask them to respond on a question.
Cool.
When you think of voting for a book, for an award, we list ours on the Dragon Awards as being put down on this list your vote for the book you would recommend a friend read. How would you phrase, what do you think is the best book? What constitutes the book? What should the book do or make you feel to be a book that stands out? What makes a book stand out?
To me, it's what makes a book really stand out for me. Is so engaging that I got the book on Friday afternoon, and after 3 pots of coffee and a lot of sugar, I finished reading it on Saturday at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yes.
And I put it down.
Yeah.
And that's a book I'll go. You need to read this.
But it's hard to quantify what makes it that way,
so
right?
So what does that?
Engaging, yeah.
Genres, so that makes it, I can't say it.
It's hard to put into words. Yes, sir, over here.
I would say, I certainly love books like that, but there are other books that you can't read like that. Like, I can't read Roger Zelazny like that. I just wouldn't be able to understand it. I have to stop every now and then and think. I don't think there's any one thing, but the craft of writing is really important to me. I can't read bad writing. It has to be really well written for me to really get it.
I'm with you. I have to stop after every Hell Ride.
Hell Ride, yeah.
That gives me about 4 breaks per book.
There's a lot going on there. It kind of goes. I'm that way with Frank Herbert, though. I when I was reading the Dune books originally in college, I had to take a year between Dune books because after a whole Dune book, I'm just like, I have to get away from this for a while. Yes. It's just too much.
Hey, you're perfectly adjusted for Game of Thrones.
Yes, yes. You can get away from it for 5 years.
That's right. You sir, have read it.
To me, it's not just books that do, what you guys are describing, because those are amazing, but also they need to have a degree of staying power, and that's a tricky thing to predict.
Oh, that's important books.
Dune has staying power.
Yep.
There are plenty of books that are coming out nowadays that are super popular, and I wager there's a chunk of them that are just going to disappear into hazy memory.
I'm sort of with him. Jody and I are the reviewers for Galaxy's Edge magazine, which if you haven't discovered yet, Mike Resnick is the editor, and it's an excellent magazine. Not to mention I get paid by it. But we do a column, and we no longer call it book reviews. We call it recommended books. Because I don't like book reviews. I get book reviews. I don't like book reviews. I like to recommend books. So, and one of the things that I'll read 20 books in a 2-month period and then review 6. And the ones I pick are the ones 2 days later I find I'm thinking about it again.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I read it and enjoyed it. It can even keep me up some. But if I go, but he was, and I realize it's 3 days since I read the book, that's a book you should read, and I recommend it.
Books that you argue with in your head while you're reading them.
Well, if not argue with, at least try and
discuss.
Extrapolate past the book, sometimes. There are some horrible movies that work that way. There is probably no worse movie this generation than Batman versus Superman. But everyone's four of the scenes in that movie are thought-provoking to the point of making you think about it later.
I'm one of the few people who actually likes that movie for different reasons. I think it's a great epic. It's not a comic book movie, but it's an epic. But I know I'm alone.
That requires so many suspensions of disbelief, yes, and stupidity on the part of so many people.
And, yes.
Because there's so many, yes, movies like that now, though. I mean,
what makes you want to stick with a book like that? I have to care about the characters. The writing has to be,
right,
the character of somebody that I, at least one of the characters I've got to care about.
Well, I want to tell you this. There, just because of you can't put a book down, at least for me, does not mean I'm going to think it was a great book when it's done. And the primary example I would hold up to you is the Jack Reacher books. I'll pick up a Jack Reacher book like at Costco, read like 20 pages of it, standing there, buy it, take it home, finish it in 2 days, couldn't put it down, and at the end I'm like... The doctor's coming.
The doctor's coming.
That,
yes,
was not where I was going with that, honestly. Maybe he's a Reacher fan, but no, I'll put the.
Hi, dear, I'm in a panel.
Well, we know who it is, so we defer.
Say hi to Jody.
Hi, Jody.
When I was talking about reading it straight through.
Yeah, call Rachel.
I don't do that. And I have bought books that I thought would be,
sorry,
really good. Started reading them and got halfway through it and went,
eh. Oh, no, I finished the dang Reacher books. I've got to know what happens. And at the end, I just want to wash my hands. I feel dirty.
So they don't have to be great books. I mean, Dan Brown's books,
yeah,
are have to read instantly, and they're badly written. So, but they're written well enough that I gotta go because he's the master of one thing: cliffhanging chapters.
And that's a big part of it too.
Boom! I gotta find out.
So Fritz Leiberg invented a word for that: word ooze. Remember from, yeah, from the silver eggheads?
Grip in, yeah.
Word ooze.
Yes, sir.
I like books that challenge my perspective on things, especially in science fiction. Things that almost give me a chill, like reading some of the early hard sci-fi by Greg Bear. Mm-hmm. Some of the perspectives and the ways you do it, Blood Music, mm-hmm, really challenged my view of the world.
No kidding.
And like, I just finished the Three Body Problem, and I wasn't sure what to expect, but I picked it up because it was going to be something different because it was translated from Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself was interesting, but then when it gets into the more hard quantum physics, mm-hmm, and that sort of stuff, it just kind of blew my mind about where we might be able to go someday. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we can, but...
Well, that's what we want science fiction to do, right, among other things, is make us challenge, you know, our ideas and perceptions.
I want to violate perhaps the rules of your podcast, but you want certain books to be mind fucks. I mean, that's seriously what it was. And, yeah, and the 60s sometimes did that. When I read Stand on Zanzibar, that was like, you know, my head was exploding. That's the way I felt. That my head was exploding.
How do you guys feel about stuff like McCaffrey's Dragon?
I haven't written the Dragon. They gave you two choices when I was in high school getting in the science fiction book club. You could go the Dragon Riders of Pern route, or you could go the Amber route with Zelazny, and I think you pretty well know which route I went. Yeah. So I never went back over to the other side.
Okay, the Anne McCaffrey books,
yeah,
are people books. Mm-hmm. Very people books. Now, since my wife has collaborated on 5 novels with her, at my insistence, among other things. I'm married to Jody Lynn Nye. Anne's books are very different from Roger's books. They're both technically very good books. Anne was a very, mm-hmm, careful technical writer, came up in the tradition of the same people. She knew Roger, she knew Asimov and all these people. And, like I said, she fed a lot of them as, mm-hmm, they were building their careers. But her books were and always will be people stories, almost soap operas. It wasn't very far from the Pern books to Restoree. Yeah. So they make you, and they're much more comfortable books. Roger's books can make you actually uncomfortable, mm-hmm, reading on occasion, and at least take you somewhere very different. Annie wrote sometimes like that, such as the ship books.
Oh,
the,
yeah,
ship crew books.
Those are great.
Which really move you out of your head. And if people like Roger would like the Shapu books, not the Pern books.
Yeah.
And but her books are also much more emotional in some ways, and less action-oriented, much more personal interaction-oriented.
And what most people forget is that it's a science fiction series. It was published in analog. The first book and the first couple of books, I think, were serialized in analog.
Yeah, it's all genetic manipulation. It's all a nearby planet coming by.
Yep.
Everything is science fiction, which she fervently and constantly announced.
Yes, exactly. It's not a fantasy series.
And they're also a social commentary series. They started in the 60s. And there was very much social commentary series in there. I remember one incident about people in general and sexuality. And she pointed out that at a library conference that when your dragons rise and mate, you mate. You become sexually attracted.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to read carefully before you figure out that browns and greens mate and they both have men on them.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And she was at an ALA meeting, the American Library Association.
And she didn't bring it, shall we say, to the fore.
And she was asked about this, and she answered honestly that, yeah, the browns and the greens will go up and mate along with the, you know, the gold. And, and one of the women stood up, and she said it was even a gray-haired woman, which by this point Annie was, too, but
yep.
Hers normally had red and purple in it, and said, Mrs. McCaffrey, aren't the writers on both of those men? Doesn't that mean... Oh, Mrs. McCaffrey. And she sat down.
She was hoping for a denial.
And Annie went, yep.
Scandalized.
This is in the 60s.
We got maybe time for one more question, and then I will admonish you all about the app. So any other last question for our panelists here, or for me? Yes, sir, right here.
If there are any of those...
That's
that
right.
And on the Hugo thing, absolutely not.
Right.
Absolutely not on the Hugo. The Nebula has a billion. Skylight Duquesne, you have to like, you know, pulp literature.
Right.
And it's great for that. And the Skylight series is not my favorite
just to see what it's like.
But I like the Lensman. The Lensman was fantastic.
Gray Lensman works.
I picked
the first
up
three
Lensman.
Lensman are strong.
I picked up a Lensman a few years ago and opened it and like in the first few words, they're jumping into their diesel-powered rocket ship, and I'm like, this may not be for me today.
You gotta,
you know, I appreciate it for what it is. Sure, absolutely. But it's
if you think that technology is bad, you should hear the social statements.
Oh, yeah.
You don't even think about Jews and blacks in those books.
But the thing, well, I don't even know they mention them, but of course it's very open-minded about aliens, and that's was sort of a parallel. So, I mean, if you think you know, Smith, Doc Smith, he has all these weird aliens. No matter how they're shaped, they can become Lensmen.
Metaphorical.
It's just like the Green Lantern Corps.
It was a racial metaphor. Thing while still reflecting pre-World War II society.
Yes,
and
very slick.
Yes, exactly.
Very well done, yeah.
Remember, they started in like 1930, I think.
Yeah, it was pre-World War II society in Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
The same society gave rise to the Nazis and Stalin.
Yes, and America to some degree.
Well, gentlemen, we have reached the end. I will remind everybody that we, if you go to the DragonCon app, make sure that you give a glowing 5-star review for this panel and for this track. And if you did not like this panel, give it a 5-star review just to make us do harder next year. And if you absolutely hate this panel, this is the Brit track.
Hey, I like Brit track.
Once again, all right, so thank you so much, and we'll see you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.